Shalom and welcome to Rambam Yomi. This is Rabbi Mati Novik. Join me as we learn the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, one perek each day. Before beginning the detailed examination of all of the Malachot, starting in Perek Chet, we pause today to go back to selected parts of the first seven prakim of Hilchot Shabbat in order to investigate further certain details which we didn't have time for when we learned these prakim the first time. Recall that we have 3 extra days to learn Hilchot Shabbat based on the Rambam Yomi calendar, so today's will be the first of 3 additional shiurim of this type. We begin in Perek Aleph, where the Rambam introduced several fundamental principles about the Isser Melacha on Shabbat. One of these is the concept of Davar Sheino Mitkaven and the related notion of Psik Reshe. To review, Davar Sheino Mitkaven is when someone performs an act which is not per se a Melacha, but which may end up accomplishing one. A classic example is dragging a bench over a dirt surface, which may dig up earth in violation of the Melacha of Choresh. Rabbi Yehuda believes that this type of activity is usser, while Rabbi Shimon thinks it is mutter, and the halacha is in accordance with Rabbi Shimon. However, if the malacha is not merely a possible, but a certain byproduct of the action, then this is called a psik reshe, and even Rabbi Shimon agrees that the act is forbidden. In fact, psik reshe is more stringent even for Rabbi Yehuda, as Rabbi Yehuda considers a general davar sheino mitkaven to be asur midrabanan, while a psik reshe is asur midoraita according to all opinions, because it is considered the equivalent of a davar hamitkaven, a malacha done with full intent. However, there are certain situations where Rishonim and Achronim are lenient in cases of psik reshe, when some mitigating factor exists, and we mention some of these now. The earliest of these to appear in the halachic literature is psik reshe delo nichale, a psik reshe in which the malacha which is done produces no benefit to the person doing it. For example, an act which ends up irrigating someone else's field. Tosfot in several places quote the opinion of the Aruch, one of the early Rishonim, that this type of psik reshe is entirely permitted. Halacha doesn't follow this view, but most Rishonim conclude that a psik reshe delo nichale is forbidden only midirabanan, and therefore may be permitted if some other mitigating factor is also present. Another question which comes up is whether psik reshe may be permitted when the malacha which is done as a result is itself only midirabanan. The Mishnah Berurah believes that the Rama allows a psik reshe when the malacha performed is doubly derabanan, meaning it lacks at least 2 conditions necessary for the malacha to be asur midoraita. The specific case is relevant to the malacha of tzad, trapping, and I hope to mention it when we learn Perek Yud. The Magen Avraham and other Achronim allow asking a non-Jew to do an act which will lead to a malacha as a psik reshe. Finally, there is a machloket achronim about the interesting case of safek psik reshe, meaning a certain act may or may not be a psik reshe depending on some variable which is unknown to the person doing the action. An example is closing a small drawer in which there may be a fly. If there is indeed a fly in it, then closing the drawer certainly traps the fly in violation of the malacha of tzad. But if there is no fly in the drawer, then obviously no malacha is done by closing it. The Taz believes that the Tur allows such a psik reshe, but other poskim are more skeptical about this. We move now to Perek Bet, whose topic is violating Shabbat in order to save a life, and in general what leniencies exist with regard to a chole, a sick patient on Shabbat. The Rambam begins the Perek with a statement that Shabbat is dichuya, pushed aside, in a case where someone's life is in danger. The Kesef Mishnah points out that in using this term, the Rambam may be making a very important conceptual point. In several places in Halacha, in which a prohibition is set aside because of some overriding factor, the question arises whether the prohibition is merely dechuya, set aside but still fundamentally extant, or if the override is especially strong and the prohibition is hutra, completely permitted and no longer usser at all. The nafka minot of this question typically relate to whether one must make an effort to minimize the violation of the isser. In a situation of dechuya, it would seem that one must do so. But in a situation of hutra, there is no need, as there is no isser being violated at all. In using the term dechuya, the Rambam seems to be taking a very clear side regarding this issue of pikuach nefesh on Shabbat. The Kesef Mishnah makes reference to 2 questions about Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbat, which Rishonim explicitly tie to this issue of Hutra versus Dechuya. One is the question of ribui shiurim, which we mentioned in our shiur on Perek Bet. If a chole needs two figs on Shabbat, and one has the option to cut off a branch containing two figs, or a branch containing three figs, may he cut the second? According to the Ran in Masechet Beitza, this question depends on our issue. If Pikuach Nefesh causes Shabbat to be Hutra, then he may cut either branch. But if Shabbat is only Dechuya, then he must cut the branch with only two figs, in order to minimize not only the Malacha, but the Shiur, the quantity on which the Malacha is performed. The Ran concludes that Shabbat is only Dechuya due to Pikuach Nefesh, and hence one may not cut the branch with three figs in this case. The second question quoted by the Kesef Mishnah appears in several Rishonim, including the Rashba and the Rosh. What if a chole needs meat on Shabbat, and we can either feed him from a nevela, an animal which died without shechita, or we can shecht an animal to feed him? If Shabbat is hutra, then the shechita isn't prohibited at all, so better to shecht the animal, so the chole can eat kosher rather than non-kosher meat. But if Shabbat is only dechuya, then it might not be permitted to shecht the animal in the first place, as this act still retains the status of a malacha on Shabbat, and it is preferable to violate the isser lav of eating a nevela rather than the isser karet of malacha on Shabbat. This question of hutra versus dechuya is a central one in any discussion of the parameters of pikuach nefesh on Shabbat, with many other nafkaminot suggested in the literature of the Rishonim and the Achronim. Toward the beginning of Perek Bet, the Rambam quotes the source of the heter of chilul Shabbat to save a life, from the pasuk of Asher yaseh otam ha'adam v'chai bahem. The mitzvot were given in order for us to live better lives through performing them, and so they are set aside in order to save a life. Based on this source, the heter is limited to saving a Jewish life on Shabbat, as only Jews are supposed to keep mitzvot, and thus one may not be mechalel Shabbat to save the life of a non-Jew. However, the Gemara brings up, in a different context, the factor of mishum eva. If we act in discriminatory ways vis-a-vis non-Jews, this may generate antagonism on their part toward the Jewish community, and certain otherwise forbidden acts are permitted based on this consideration. But the Gemara explicitly says that Chilul Shabbat to save a non-Jew is not included in this category, as the non-Jew should understand that Shabbat may only be violated for the benefit of those who observe it. The Chatam Sofer, writing in the 18th century, felt that circumstances had changed by that point. Non-Jews no longer accept this type of discrimination. And worse than just eva, antagonism, this may lead to genuine sakanat nefashot if non-Jewish doctors refuse in turn to treat Jewish patients. Furthermore, one of the conditions under which a doctor receives a license to practice medicine is his commitment to treat all patients equally, without discrimination. And so following the strict halacha on this matter may lead to legal troubles as well. Most recent poskim, including Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Tzitz Eliezer, and Rav Avad Yosef, accept the ruling of the Chatam Sofer and allow Chilul Shabbat nowadays to save the life of a non-Jew. An exception is the Mishnah Berurah, who felt that this heter goes too far, and was hesitant even to allow a malacha derabanan on Shabbat to save the life of a non-Jew. Even the majority of poskim, who are lenient, agree that Chilul Shabbat should be minimized to the extent possible, including taking precautions in advance of Shabbat when necessary. For instance, if two Jewish doctors are working together, they can perform each malacha together in a manner that constitutes Shnaim Shasa'uha, which we saw in Perek Aleph is only Asur Midrabanan. If one has in mind, while doing a malacha to save the life of a non-Jew, that he is doing it only to avoid danger, then this may be considered a malacha she'na tzricha l'gufa, which for many Rishonim is only Asur Midrabanan, though not for the Rambam, who believes that malacha she'na tzricha l'gufa is Asur Midoraita, also as we saw in Perek Aleph. Finally, if someone works shifts in a hospital with non-Jewish patients, he must do all he can to avoid working a shift on Shabbat. Later in Perek Bet, and again in Perek Vav, about malacha done by a non-Jew on Shabbat, the Rambam writes that one may ask a non-Jew to perform a malacha d'rabbanan for the benefit of a chole she'ein bo sakana. Is there anything which a Jew may do for such a chole? The Rambam writes a cryptic line in Perek Bet Halacha Yud. Vim hayu tzurchim lidvarim she'ein behen melacha, osinotan afilu Yisrael. At the simplest level, this says that a Jew may do anything for a chole she'ein bo sakana, which does not involve any melacha, and is therefore permitted on Shabbat. But this seems entirely obvious and goes without saying. So what is the Rambam adding here? The Magen Mishnah and the Tur read into this line a far-reaching heter. The Rambam means that anything which doesn't involve melacha de'oraita may be done by a Jew for a chole she'ein bo sakana, even if it is a full-fledged melacha de'rabanan. If this is true, why does the Rambam write in Perek Vav that one may ask a non-Jew to do a melacha de'rabanan in this case, if in fact even a Jew can do it himself? The Magen Mishnah distinguishes between the cases. The heter for a Jew to do melacha d'rabanan in Perek Bet is only for a chole she'ein bo sakana whose sickness affects his entire body, or who is in danger of losing a limb. In Perek Vav, the Rambam uses the term miktzat choli, meaning that a non-Jew may be asked to perform a melacha d'rabanan even when the chole suffers from some pain which is localized to one area of the body, and which does not pose a danger to any limb, in which case a Jew may not do any melacha. The Kesef Mishnah disputes this reading of the Rambam in Perek Bet, advanced by the Magen Mishnah on the Tur, as it seems to contradict places where the Rambam writes explicitly that a certain melacha d'rabanan should be done for a chole only by a non-Jew. In his more limited reading, when the Rambam allows a Jew to perform dvarim she'ein behen melacha, he refers to actions which are not even rabbinically prohibited forms of melacha, but rather forbidden midrabanan in general on Shabbat for other reasons entirely. For example, a gzera like climbing a tree on Shabbat. This isn't a melacha on any level, and is usur only because he may break off a branch if he does so. Or certain activities which Chazal prohibited on Shabbat simply because they are uvdin d'chol. They resemble weekday-type activities which should be avoided. These kinds of things, according to the Kesef Mishnah, may be done by a Jew for a chole she'ein bo sakana, but not any rabbinic forms of malacha, the details of which we'll learn at great length later in Hilchot Shabbat. The Shulchan Aruch quotes four opinions altogether on this topic of doing malacha d'rabanan for a chole she'ein bo sakana. The first is the expansive understanding of the Magen Mishnah in the Rambam, and the last is his own much more limited understanding of the Rambam as written in the Kesef Mishnah. In between these are the second opinion, that of the Ran, who allows a Jew to do melacha d'rabanan whenever there is a danger of loss of limb, but not otherwise, and the third opinion, that of the Ramban, who is more lenient. In case of danger to a limb, melacha d'rabanan may be performed by a Jew in any manner. But in other cases of chole she'ein bo sakana, a Jew may only do melacha d'rabanan if he performs it with a shinui, that is, he does the melacha in an abnormal way, so that it doesn't meet the criteria of melechet machshevet typically required on Shabbat. The Shulchan Aruch concludes that the halacha follows this opinion of the Ramban, and the Mishnah Berurah agrees. We move on to Perek Gimel, which deals with the rabbinic gezerot of shihiyah, leaving food to cook on a flame from before Shabbat, and hachzara, returning food to a flame on Shabbat. The Rambam discusses shihiyah at length, but mentions hachzara relatively briefly, and his psak is that two conditions are required to put a pot back on a kira after it has been removed on Shabbat. One, the kira must be garuf or katum, the same condition necessary to allow shihiyah. Two, the pot must not have been put down on the ground or on any surface like a countertop, which is an extension of the ground. The Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah list several additional conditions which must be met. First, for reasons related to the melacha of bishul, which we will learn in Perek Tet, the food in the pot must still be hot. For the Shulchan Aruch, it must still be very hot, and for the Ramah, it suffices that the food hasn't cooled down completely. The Ramah adds two more conditions. The pot must remain in someone's hand the entire time that it is off the flame, and it must be the case that when the pot was taken off the flame, this was done with intent to return it there afterwards. If either of these conditions isn't met, then when the pot is returned to the flame, we see this not as returning at all, but as a new act of placing food on the flame on Shabbat, hence it is forbidden. However, the Ramah then quotes a much more lenient opinion, that of the Ran. The entire concept of hachzara applies only to food which was taken off the flame before Shabbat, when one wishes to return it on Shabbat. But when one removes a pot from the flame on Shabbat itself, he may return it even if he had no intent to do so when he removed the pot, and even if it was placed on the ground in the interim. The Ramah acknowledges that the general custom is to follow this lenient opinion, but adds that tov lahachmir. May someone take cold cooked food out of the refrigerator on Shabbat morning and put it on a plata, a hot plate, to heat up? Many recent poskim have been lenient about this, including Rav Avadya Yosef, because no one cooks food by placing it on a plata, so this doesn't resemble cooking. Others are more stringent and require the food to be placed on some other surface above the plata, like an upside-down plate or pot. This is the situation of kedera al gabe kedera, which we discussed when we learned Perek Dalet. In Perek He, the Rambam discusses the mitzvah of lighting Neirot Shabbat before Shabbat begins. In the reality which existed before the invention of the electric light bulb, people often did not spend money on oil to light their homes at night, and managed without light in the evenings until they went to sleep. The mitzvah of lighting Neirot Shabbat is meant to prevent this practice on Shabbat, and requires that there be light in the house as a form of Oneg Shabbat, to be able both to enjoy the Shabbat meal properly and to move around the house without fear of tripping or bumping into things. In our age of electric lights, which typically illuminate the house well into the night, two questions arise. First, can electric lights be used as Neirot Shabbat in place of candles or oil and wicks? Second, given that the house is typically well lit even without specially lit Neirot Shabbat, what added benefit is provided by the Neirot Shabbat, and should one really make a bracha on lighting them? Regarding the first question, many poskim raise technical objections to the use of electric lights as Neirot Shabbat. 1. Electricity is not a physical object used as fuel, like oil or wax, and thus isn't included in the mitzvah. 2. Pressing a button or flipping a switch only indirectly causes a light to turn on, and hence this is only grumma and not a direct act of hadlaka, which the mitzvah requires. 3. The mitzvah requires that there be enough oil or wax present at the time of the lighting for the flame to last several hours, and in the case of an electric light, the electricity which will sustain it for the coming hours has not yet even been generated at the time of the lighting. This last objection clearly wouldn't apply to a battery-powered light. Some poskim also feel that one must be concerned about a blackout or a blown fuse, which can shut off all the lights and cancel the Oneg Shabbat which they provide. However, most poskim conclude that electric lights are fundamentally valid for use as Neirot Shabbat, as the point is to produce light for one's practical use, and electric lights provide this light. This is in contrast to Neirot Chanukah, for which poskim in general do not allow electric lights, but we leave this discussion for another occasion. Flipping a switch or pressing a button is considered by some of these poskim a direct act of lighting, not grumma. This leads to a chumra as well, as it means that turning on a halogen light bulb on Shabbat is a malacha d'oraita of mavir, burning, for the many poskim who consider a halogen light bulb to be the equivalent of actual fire. I hope to discuss more about electricity in general on Shabbat in a later shir. Some poskim reject the premise that a formal act of hadlaka is required at all, as the essence of the mitzvah is the light produced thereby, and these poskim allow electric lights even if activating them is only grumma. Regarding the second question of what is contributed by Neirot Shabbat when the house is well lit without them, recall that the Rambam, as well as other Rishonim, see in Neirot Shabbat not only a form of Oneg Shabbat, but also an act of Kvod Shabbat, honoring Shabbat in advance of the day by creating a solemn atmosphere. Candles, more so than electric lights, certainly contribute to this type of atmosphere, even when the home is already well lit. For this reason, even poskim who fundamentally allow electric lights for the mitzvah of Hadlakat Neirot Shabbat agree that lechatchila one should light candles of wax or oil. And if one does light only an electric light, then this should ideally be a special bulb used specifically for Shabbat, which is thus a fulfillment of Kvod Shabbat. Based on the psak of the Shulchan Aruch, that a bracha should not be recited when lighting candles in a place which is already well lit, some are machmir to light Neirot Shabbat when the electric lights are turned off. after which they can be turned on by someone else or by a Shabbat clock, because the person lighting has already been mekabel Shabbat by the very act of lighting, as we explained in our Shir on Perek Hei. Most, however, are not machmir on this point. When exactly should Neirot Shabbat be lit? This brings us to the question of when exactly Shabbat begins, and the related question of when exactly it ends. We discussed in the Shir on Perek Hei the concept of Bein Hashmashot, extending from sundown until nightfall, the emergence of three medium-sized stars. Bein Hashmashot is treated as possibly day and possibly night, and so this period of time is included in Shabbat at both ends, on Friday evening when Shabbat begins, and on Shabbat evening when it ends. Aside from this, the Gemara in Masechet Rosh Hashanah learns from Sukkim that we must add some time to the day of Yom Kippur, both when it begins and when it ends. While the Rambam brings this din of Tosefet, extra time, only in the context of Yom Kippur, the majority of Rishonim apply it to every day of Kodesh, including Shabbat. There is no clear consensus among Rishonim and Achronim how much time exactly to add as Tosefet to the start of Shabbat, with opinions ranging from just a few minutes to half an hour, or even 40 minutes in Yerushalayim. The general custom is to add either 18 or 20 minutes before sundown, and this is typically the time which appears as Zman Hadlakat Neirot in calendars. The requirement of Tosefet exists at the end of Shabbat as well, and the general custom is to use a more stringent opinion than usual in calculating when night begins, that is, the emergence of three medium-sized stars. And the time added by this stringent opinion counts as Tosefet Shabbat. This typically works out to be anywhere between 30 and 45 minutes after sundown. In this context, we should mention a much more stringent practice, accepted by the Shulchan Aruch, but not by the Gra, to wait longer for the end of Shabbat based on the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam had a completely different calculation of Bein Hashmashot, which he believed to begin only about an hour after the sun dips below the horizon. This means that Shabbat ends approximately 90 minutes after sundown. While we may not rely on Rabbeinu Tam when this leads to a leniency, meaning to continue doing malacha for an hour after sundown on Friday, many posts can believe that due to the severity of the Isser malacha and the fact that the opinion of Rabbeinu Tam is accepted by the Shulchan Aruch, one should be machmir to follow this opinion and extend Shabbat until 90 minutes after sundown at the end. Many have this practice, but many more do not adopt this chumrah. We conclude this shiur with some details about the prohibition of Amira l'Nochri, asking a non-Jew to do malacha on Shabbat, which we didn't get to discuss in our shiur on Perek Vav. The Rambam explained the reason for this isser as Kedei Shelo Tehei Shabbat Kala Be'inav, so that Shabbat not be considered a light matter in the eyes of the Jew, which may lead him to do malacha himself. Rashi in Masechet Avodah Zarah gives an entirely different explanation, namely that the very act of asking a non-Jew to do malacha is a violation of v'daber davar, speaking on Shabbat in the manner one speaks during the week. We'll learn more about this isser and how the Rambam interprets it when we get to Perek Kaf Dalet. The Avnei Nezer points out that according to Rashi's understanding, which identifies the problem of Amira l'Nochri in the request itself, rather than in the non-Jew's performance of malacha, it would be permitted to ask the non-Jew before Shabbat to do malacha on Shabbat, and conversely, it would be prohibited to ask him on Shabbat to do malacha after Shabbat. The Rambam explicitly argues on the first of these points, as even asking the non-Jew before Shabbat to do malacha on Shabbat leads to a problem of Shelo Tehei Shabbat Kala Be'inav. He mentions nothing about the second point, and may believe that asking a non-Jew on Shabbat to perform malacha after Shabbat does not constitute a problem of V'daber Davar. What exactly constitutes asking a non-Jew to perform a malacha? The Rama writes that just as one may not explicitly ask him to do malacha, he may also not hint to him that this malacha should be done. This refers only to a request on Shabbat to do malacha on Shabbat. However, he may hint to the non-Jew before Shabbat to do malacha on Shabbat, or on Shabbat to do malacha after Shabbat. The Magen Avraham distinguishes between two types of hinting. He limits the Isser of Amira l'Nochri to a hint which resembles a request, not one which just describes a situation, and from which the non-Jew can understand by himself what to do. So, for example, if the Jew wants the light turned on in his kitchen, he may not say to the non-Jew, It would be great if I could have light in my kitchen, as this resembles a request. But he can say, it's very dark in my kitchen, I can't see anything there, as this merely describes the problem without suggesting a solution in any way. Needless to say, even when hinting in this manner to a non-Jew, we must remember the rules outlined in Perek Vav about benefiting from melacha done by a non-Jew on Shabbat, even when he isn't asked. If the non-Jew performs melacha in response to an acceptable hint, this will not help if one is not allowed to benefit from the melacha that he performs. We'll continue tomorrow, Bezrat Hashem, with Perek Chet. Thank you for joining me in learning today's Perek of the Mishneh Torah. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas you'd like to share, I'd be happy to hear from you. Send me an email at mtorahyomi@gmail.com. That's M as in Mishnah, Torah, T-O-R-A-H, Yomi, Y-O-M-I, @gmail.com. Come back tomorrow as we continue with our next parak.